Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Economics Report and American Mosaic, coming up after As It Is.
Hello again and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. We are here 7 days a week to help you learn and improve your American English. We suggest you use our website to read along as you listen to the audio. You can even print the stories and save the podcasts for later. Today we return to Nigeria with more information about the rebel group Boko Haram. An international humanitarian organization provides us with information about the harm done by the group and where attacks have taken place. Then we travel to Syria. The United Nations reports about women in that war-torn country and how they have been especially affected by the violence. The news may be good or bad, but we bring it to you as it is each day on VOA. Now, here is part one. Human Rights Watch says the Nigerian rebel group Boko Haram has killed more than 2,000 people in the first 6 months of this year. It says the group's attacks are crimes against humanity. Christopher Cruz has been studying the most recent information and joins us with details.
Corinne Dufka is West Africa Director of Human Rights Watch. She says Boko Haram is making war against the people of northeastern Nigeria. She says this aggression is causing what she calls a staggering human cost.
We have documented 95 attacks on 70 towns and villages.
She said most of the attacks happened in northeastern Nigeria. Boko Haram kidnapped an estimated 276 schoolgirls from that area in April. Boko Haram has also carried out attacks in the capital, Abuja. Ms. Dufka says her group used media reports and information from human rights groups and others to confirm that Boko Haram has caused more than 2,000 deaths since January.
We analyzed these reports looking at, again, credible reports of morgue workers, local officials, civilians, witnesses who had seen the bodies buried or registered. And we came up with this figure, which is probably conservative.
She says the attacks have greatly increased since a state of emergency was declared in three northern states. The emergency conditions took effect in Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe states in May 2013. Human Rights Watch says there has been a sharp increase this year in deaths from bomb explosions, including suicide bombings. Ms. Dufka says the attacks should be considered crimes against humanity. She said the crimes include murder, torture, rape, and other actions done as part of what Human Rights Watch calls a widespread or systematic attack.
And we believe that the nature of these attacks, the similarity, the organized nature in which they're being committed, suggests that they really are crimes against humanity.
One of Boko Haram's actions included kidnapping the schoolgirls from the town of Chibok. Human Rights Watch says there have also been many attacks on schools where male students were killed. In February, an attack on the federal government college in Yobe State killed 59 boys. Ms. Dufka says Human Rights Watch and other groups also have confirmed abuses by Nigerian security forces. It says they include use of unreasonable force, detentions without charge, the burning of homes, and killing suspected Boko Haram supporters.
The government of Nigeria, regardless of how egregious these attacks are, they have to abide by international law when responding to them.
She says the Nigerian government must not only protect the population from Boko Haram, She says Nigeria must also protect against security forces that may operate outside the law. I'm Christopher Cruz.
A United Nations study says women are now heading more than 145,000 refugee families from the conflict in Syria. The UN Refugee Agency looked at Syrian families in four other Middle Eastern countries, Egypt, Lebanon, Iraq, and Jordan. It found that these women, their children, and other relatives are trapped in a world of poverty, loneliness, and fear. Anna Mateo tells us more.
A United Nations survey found that one in four Syrian women have been forced to flee their homes because of fighting. It says these women face the possibility of spending their lives alone in exile. They do not have husbands who can help care for them and their families. This situation would be difficult for anyone, but it is especially hard for Syrian women who come from a very traditional, conservative society. In such a society, a woman without a man has no rank or standing. She could be treated as an outcast, someone who is rejected by her community. Melissa Fleming works for the UN Refugee Agency. She says these women are extremely worried about how they will live and support their families alone in a foreign country. Ms. Fleming uses words like isolated, vulnerable, and frightened in describing the situations of these women.
Their biggest anxiety was about money, resources. They also felt very isolated, frightened to move around out of the house. They felt vulnerable to harassment, vulnerable to attacks by men. So it's the climate of being a refugee in many cases is extremely worrying and very tough.
The UN report is based on the personal statements of 135 women over a three-month period. The survey found the majority of Syrian refugees in the Middle East do not live in camps. Officials say the camps would provide them with a safer environment, meals, and other assistance. Instead, the report says, the refugee women live in towns and cities, in damaged shelters, and rooms where vehicles are normally kept. Some women pay extremely high rates for rented rooms. It says only one-fifth of refugee women have paid work, and many find it hard to get a job. It says many women face abuse, are subject to rape, sexual abuse, and other forms of aggression. Melissa Fleming says many female-headed households do not have enough money for food, housing, and major expenses. They are forced to choose between sending their children to school or out to work.
This is also another huge worry for these women. First of all, their children have seen things that no child should ever see back home in Syria during the war. They come out, they're traumatized, they've lost friends. And the thing that they all want most is for that child to heal and to go back to school. But they can't afford to send that child back to school, so they send their child, and think hopefully this is temporary, to work.
Since the beginning of the year, the UN Refugee Agency says it has been registering 100,000 new Syrian refugees every month. At this rate, it says, it expects the number of Syrian refugees to grow from the current 2.8 million to 3.6 million by the end of the year. I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Thank you for joining us for this edition of As It Is. Please remember to write to us and tell us how you hear our programs and the kinds of things that you find interesting. Learning English is a part of the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington.
The Economics Report is next, followed by American Mosaic. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. The political crisis in Ukraine has forced many European nations to reconsider their dependence on Russia for energy. Some nations are looking at new ways to recover natural gas at home. These methods include a disputed process known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking. The process involves the use of liquid chemicals to break rock. Experts believe Europe might have trillions of cubic meters of shale gas. Shale is a kind of rock. France, Poland, and Ukraine are thought to have the largest amounts of shale gas. Large supplies have been found in Romania, Bulgaria, and Britain. Lucia Seibert is with the Wilson Center in Washington. She says the presence of large shale gas reserves and political problems in Ukraine have increased interest in Europe's shale gas.
With energy security, it's not just a matter of supply, it's also a question of reliability. And one thing that this may do, it may expedite some of these explorations of shale gas within the European Union.
But Europe is believed to be years away from major shale gas production. Poland, Britain, and Romania are expected to start exploration by 2020. Removing shale gas through hydraulic fracking is the subject of often intense debate. Most drilling areas in Europe are near populated areas, and environmental groups have raised concerns about water and air pollution from fracking. There also are political concerns. Eric Stewart is the president of the Romanian American and Polish American Business Councils. He says European taxes and rules on the industry make it difficult for gas removal companies. Energy companies also must battle a strong environmental movement and public opposition. Keith Smith is a former U.S. ambassador to Lithuania. He says the fracking can help Europe meet its energy needs if the plan includes fossil fuels and renewable sources of energy like solar and wind. Much of Europe's gas flows through a pipeline from Russia across Ukraine. But Ukraine has had difficulty paying Russia's Gazprom energy company. And earlier this year, Ukrainian protesters ousted the country's pro-Russia president. The new government signed economic agreements with the European Union over Russian objections. Now, Russia has signaled it may cut off gas to Ukraine and to much of Europe. The Wilson Center's Lucia Seibert says shale gas exploration will not provide Europe complete energy independence from Russian imports, but it will reduce that dependence in the long term. And that's the Economics Report from VOA Learning English. I'm Mario Ritter.
Welcome to American Mosaic from VOA Learning English. I'm June Sims. Today on the show, we listen to some new recordings by two singer-songwriters. We also look at the expanding links between the museum world and Hollywood. But first, we tell about some unusual young people who work to make a difference in the world. Most teenagers in the United States spend their time trying to make time for school, family, and friends. But some choose bigger goals. Christopher Cruz tells us about three American teens working to make a difference in the world.
At age 15, Winter Vinecki has already had more successes than most people have in their lifetime.
I recently completed a marathon on all seven continents and became the youngest person in the world to do so, and I really was doing this for my dad.
Doctors discovered Winter's father had a rare and aggressive form of prostate cancer when she was 9 years old. He died 10 months later.
When he was first diagnosed, I immediately knew I had to do something to help him. That's when I formed Team Winter for prostate cancer research and awareness.
Through Team Winter and social media, Winter Vinecki has raised almost $500,000. She has taken prostate cancer education worldwide, from Kenya to Mongolia, through foot races called marathons on seven continents. In the United States, she travels continually to talk about prostate cancer and urge others to act. Winter Vinecki spoke recently at a conference in Los Angeles, California. She was one of several teenagers who spoke about young people who are living extraordinary lives.
So prostate cancer is much more common, but the men don't want to talk about it. So that's why a 9-year-old girl had to go out there and start talking about it for them.
Another speaker was Jack Andreka. He invented an inexpensive sensor that identifies cancers of the pancreas, ovaries, and lungs. He was 15 at the time.
Without Google and Wikipedia, I would have never been able to learn all the stuff I needed for this project. I mean, I didn't even know what pancreas was before developing my test for pancreatic cancer.
Jack is now 17 and seeking patents for his latest inventions. He has developed low-cost water quality devices. They help identify and remove heavy metals and poisonous chemicals from water.
I hope to see them employed in the developing nations such as Bangladesh and parts of China and India, especially as well as in parts of Africa, where these heavy metal and pesticide and other industrial effluents are a major problem.
16-year-old Mary Pat Hector saw a problem in her own community. She says too many young people were dying in gun violence.
It was seeing my friends hurt. It was seeing it on the television constantly. It kind of made me feel like I had to do something about it.
So Mary Pat became the national youth director of one of the largest U.S. civil rights organizations, the National Action Network. She also started a campaign to educate young people about gun violence.
My 8-year-old brother drives me. I think about how innocent he is, and I just want the world to be a better place for him and my children.
Mary Pat Hector, Jack Andreka, and Winter Vinecki say a combination of supportive parents, the internet, and social media has helped them succeed. But Winter and Jack also credit their inner selves.
I think the biggest thing for kids and adults is to never let age and gender be a barrier, and to not just dream, but to dream big.
Never let anyone else tell you no. always keep going for your dream and think if a 15-year-old could do it, just think what you could do.
They say with that kind of thinking, anything is possible.
For years, objects used in movies and those celebrated in popular culture have made appealing museum exhibits. The famed jeweled shoes or ruby slippers from the film The Wizard of Oz are an example. The shoes attract many visitors to the Smithsonian National Museum of American History in Washington. A model of the imaginary spacecraft USS Enterprise from the television series Star Trek hung for years at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in the same city. But some museums are taking another step. Museums are now developing exhibits centered on movies based on real events. Like the Oscar-winning movie Argo. The 2012 film was based on a secret U.S. intelligence operation. Central Intelligence agent Tony Mendez led the action that rescued six American diplomats from Iran in 1980. The International Spy Museum in Washington has made Argo the subject of an exhibit. Visitors can look at real photos and documents about the operation. Jason Worden is the museum's public relations manager.
Tony and John Mendez both are founding members of the International Spy Museum and brought their expertise in their history of the CIA to tell this story of Argo from the real case that occurred in 1979-1980.
Another film-related exhibit at the museum is called Exquisitely Evil, 50 Years of Bond's Villains. It explores the imaginary enemies of Hollywood's most famous fictional spy. Television is also represented at the Spy Museum. The Americans is a spy show set in the 1980s. The museum exhibit identifies some of the truths within the fiction. The Newseum is another museum that includes a little Hollywood action among its exhibits. One popular exhibit features the 2004 humor film Anchorman. Actor Will Ferrell plays a news announcer in the 1970s at a television station in San Diego, California. The character, Ron Burgundy, is always clashing with a female announcer at the station. The exhibit caught the attention of museum visitor Jim Mulvaney.
I'm surprised they went to so much detail and kept so many props, you know. So, yeah, I'm enjoying it. Bring back a lot of the funny moments from the film for me.
Newseum official Jonathan Thompson says visitors see both the light and more serious sides of the news business.
Women in the newsroom were discriminated against, and in the past 30 to 40 years, women in the newsroom have come a long way. And that's one of the serious stories that we tell in this exhibit, in addition to, of course, the lighthearted, humorous moments.
Maggie Stogner is a professor of film and arts at American University in Washington. She says popular entertainment and museum exhibits are a good combination.
I really do think it gives Hollywood another opportunity to take the material that they create, often wonderful material, into new venues, to be experienced by new audiences that wouldn't necessarily experience it.
St. Vincent is an American singer-songwriter. So is Ray LaMontagne. Today, we listen to their latest albums and find out more about who they are. Marcia James reports.
St. Vincent was not born St. Vincent. Her real name is Annie Clark, and she comes from the state of Oklahoma. She currently lives in New York City. Recently, she released her fourth album, called Saint Vincent. Annie Clark told a reporter that the new album is very unself-conscious, a little lighter than her past records. She described it as a party record you could play at a funeral. She starts Saint Vincent off with Rattlesnake.
Follow the power lines back from the road. No one around, so I take off my clothes. Am I the only one in the only world?
LaMontagne released Supernova, his fifth studio album, last month. The 40-year-old was born in Maine and now lives in the nearby state of Massachusetts. Critics and fans alike have noted a new, different sound for LaMontagne on this album. There is a quality of the psychedelic like one might find on a Pink Floyd record. Ray LaMontagne told Rolling Stone magazine that he just let the songs happen. Julia was one of the results. Vincent plans on performing at some shows in the upcoming Black Keys concert series. Here is the bouncy Regret from Saint Vincent.
Morning, bright windows open, let in. What's so terrifying? Summer is as faded as a long cicada. So bright, I got a squint just to recall. Regret the words I've bitten. More than the ones I ever said. Who's the one?
We leave you with Ray LaMontagne performing the title song from his new album, Supernova.
So you and me, we've been hanging out now. Ever since we were kids, just kicking around this town. So you know me and I don't back down. I know what I want, I think I found it. I want you to be my girl. I want you to be my girl. So
June Sims. Our program was written and produced by Katie Weaver. Join us again next week for American Mosaic from VOA Learning English.